Want more?
You don't have money, Peach.
He picked something out of his molar. I stared at the envelope between us. I need money. I need to bury my mom, pay her rent, pay her credit cards. I licked my pinky and pressed it to the pill, lifting it to my mouth. Mick blew out hot, sour breath, leaned back, and dug in his jeans pocket. He came up with a small white envelope, about the size of a playing card. He slid it under my thigh, his palm resting on my knee for a beat too long.
Unload these for 10 each. We'll split the profit. You can keep one for every 10 you get rid of.
I pulled the envelope out and pinched it open. Inside were 10 little white pills. I gave him a look. No, but my heart thumped in my chest.
Okay, then. Got a better idea?
The smirk on his face made me want to slap him. I sealed the envelope back up and stuck it in my back pocket. All those little tickets to oblivion.
See you in a week, Peach.
At first, we met weekly. But then I started seeking Mick out, calling his phone. I needed more than one of those little tabs. They made me feel like I could solve my problems. I figured out that the stay-at-home moms in Berkeley loved legal pills. Oxy, Vicodin, whatever Mick gave me, it didn't matter. Plus, I didn't look like a drug dealer. I took a shower, washed my hair. I was in college. I took the BART down a few times a week and hung out in Cragmont Park. It was all so fucking civil. I never felt weird or creepy hovering around playgrounds peddling pills to pristine little blonde women. I was one of them. I'd watch them pay their 10 bucks, pulling from stacks of green tucked inside Chanel purses. They parted with it so easily. And then they'd slip the pills between their teeth, swallow once, and kiss their fat, drooly babies, burying their noses in downy soft hair. They'd wander away, pushing bugaboo prams, holding hands with their skipping 6-year-olds, and I'd sit under the gazebo, watching them sway and giggle until I couldn't see them anymore. I felt weird about selling to students, that somehow it was less destructive to supply professors' bored wives with pep pills. Besides, the students scared me. Their fresh-faced happiness was so familiar. It gave me a pain right below my breastbone. I couldn't look them in the eye, couldn't pull off being one of them. No, the moms were easier, at least if I didn't think about it too hard. Sometimes it was too tempting to take more than I was supposed to for myself. I started charging them double, literally eating the profits. What did they care? A 20 was as easy to hand over as a 10, and then at least they didn't have to worry about change. I called Mick, needing almost double the supply, running a game with myself. Meanwhile, I was getting higher and higher every day. 2 pills a day, 4, then 2 at night. All the while, spending my nights at the bar, my nose buried in a tumbler of vodka. I didn't even bother with the lemon anymore.
What am I gonna do with my life, Mick? I was whining.
Bury your mom. Live in her apartment. Get a job.
He shrugged, a toothpick between his teeth.
It's what people do, Hillary.
I didn't need life lessons from Mick. He was a bigger mess than me. I threw what little money I had on the bar and stood up and wobbled. Mick stuck his arm out and caught me. He led me out the door and we walked the 4 blocks to Evelyn's apartment. In the morning, I crept out and vomited in the street. Maybe it was the booze, maybe it was the pills. Mostly it was just me and my self-loathing. In oblivion, the pain in my stomach went away. I could eat, albeit small amounts. If I stayed high enough, I no longer felt high. I felt normal, functioning. I could conduct small talk with the sales clerks and passengers on the bus, cab drivers and people in elevators. The pills became a necessity. They kept me feeling normal. They calmed my racing heart and the all-encompassing anxiety.
My money stack was growing, but it still wasn't enough to ward off the eventual eviction notice. I thought about throwing a few $100 to the landlord, a fat, greasy, bald man I'd seen lumbering around the hallways knocking on other deadbeats' doors. I thought about taping an envelope to the door in good faith. I worried it would get stolen. Sometimes details hang you up, propel you to inaction. More purgatory. I started partying at night with Mick. We ended up at some guy's apartment whose name I never knew, and they passed me a pipe, and I smoked it. It was the easiest 4 hours of my life. I felt free, like it was all going to be okay. I felt beautiful, I felt accomplished, like I could just go back and finish college, maybe even that night. Everything felt so goddamn possible, where all I had gotten used to seeing was depressing impossibilities. I woke up on the floor of Mick's room the next morning, sticky and sour and sweating. He was gone, but in his place, in his bed, sat a young girl. Had to be 16, 15, too young. My bowels churned. Whether it was from the comedown or the girl, I didn't know. "Who the fuck are you?" I was pissed. She was so goddamn young. She shrugged, but she looked terrified, pressed her back up against the headboard, staring at me with bulging black-rimmed eyes. I went to the living room and called Mick, left a colorful message. When I turned around, there she stood, all gamine and doe-eyed. "How old are you?"
18.
Her mouth twitched. "Bullshit," I hissed. She barely had breasts. I was struck with a stupid, irrational idea. "Come with me. Let's go somewhere. Coffee. Whatever." She looked at me like I'd lost my mind, too jaded for her age.
"You're a crazy bitch if you think I'ma go with you."
But her shoulders rounded. I could feel it. It wouldn't take much to convince her. How could I save someone when I couldn't even save myself? "Please," I mouthed. She stepped away from me, her eyes wildly scanning the room. "I need help," I said. It wasn't a lie. "What's your name?"
"How the fuck am I gonna help you? You'll get me killed."
"Let me help you, then. How old are you?"
"Fuck you," she whispered,
and then pulled down her lower lip. A black brand on the wet, pink skin. One word. Jared. Inked by an amateur, the lowercase D crooked and dangling off the corner like it could fall right out of her mouth. There was a knock at the door and her eyes went wide, terrified. I flung it open to a hulk of a man who reared back, not expecting me. His wide, flat nostrils flared, his eyes slit, thin as razor blades. On the left side of his face, from chin to forehead, was a long, fat scar, as red and furious and flashing as his eyes. He leaned in close, smelled like cigarettes and weed. He had on a light black jacket, the silver glint of a gun on the inside.
"Who are you?"
I backed away from the door. My teeth ached, my jaw felt clenched shut. I pressed my palm flat against the door and reached my arm out to her. The man grabbed my hand away, twisted it behind my back until I yelped in pain.
"Don't you fucking touch her."
She scampered past me, shooting back one empty, haunted look. Dark eyes, still and deep as a quarry. She buttoned her shirt as she ran. The man followed her out and, once they reached the dusty sedan, pushed her roughly into the back seat, where at least two other girls were waiting. As the car sped away, I wrote down the license plate. Sure, it would get me nowhere. It was most likely stolen. I felt like I'd been doused with ice water. I looked around. A month's worth of newspapers, ashtrays, and cigarette boxes, clothes everywhere, garbage on every flat surface, flies buzzing around the mouths of sticky, empty liquor bottles. The filth. It all became crystal clear in that moment. I was part of this. I was as much a lowlife as Mick, only steps away from being abused like Evelyn,
like that young girl. I saw, for the first time, my own greasy complexion, the whiteheads that dotted my hairline from the drugs, my ragged, bitten nails from nerves, the dirt on the knees of my jeans. I grabbed my purse and flung it over my shoulder. When I opened the front door, Mick was standing there, his key poised above the lock.
"Where you headed, Peach?" he drawled.
God, that smirk. "I'm out of here, Mick."
"D'ya meet Rosie?"
"The girl. She's got to be 15, Mick. I had to get the hell out of there." He shrugged.
"Jay says 18. I go by what he says."
"Bye, Mick." I hauled ass home, where I stayed for a week. No pills, no booze. I shook, I paced, I lay in bed steeped in my own sweat, my breath coming in gulps. The days blended together, my body feeling like I'd just run 50 miles. My knees and ankles ached and popped when I walked to the bathroom. Mick pounded on Evelyn's door, his deep voice filling the apartment, first worried, then desperate, then angry, furiously angry. He came back every day. When the worst of it passed, I checked my phone. Missed calls from the coroner's office and 3 voicemails. I eyed the half-full manila envelope on my dresser as I listened to weeks-old messages. Knowing I'd missed the deadline was more manageable without confirmation. His voice rattled in my ear. They had to make decisions without me. I knew what that meant. A state-funded cremation and a common burial. Funny how they make it sound so nice. All it meant was Evelyn's ashes would be buried with any other unclaimed body. Other lowlifes who couldn't afford funerals, druggies and drunks. I didn't even call him back. I didn't know how much a person could hate herself until that moment. I couldn't get the image of Evelyn lying in a mass grave surrounded by other decaying corpses out of my mind, even though she was cremated, even though the coroner had explained it wasn't like that, that it was more humane than that. I had voicemails from friends at school, mostly Molly, wondering where I was, if I was okay. Would I please call someone back? I couldn't get Rosie out of my mind, the fear on her face, the hopelessness in her eyes, that back seat full of Rosies, their long skinny legs layered like pretzel sticks. Days later, I found myself at the Richmond Police Department filling out an incident report. I couldn't fit all my observations in the lines provided. "I just want to talk to someone, please." My nose wouldn't stop running, and the receptionist just stared at me in disgust. Hadn't she ever seen a sick person? She worked in a police station, for God's sake. They led me to an interview room, and a young 20-something officer set a cup of water on the table. He sat across from me with a legal pad and a digital recorder. I told him everything. I gave him Mick's name, Jared's name. I told him what I did, the pills I sold and where, what I saw about Rosie and the car full of girls, how young they looked. I didn't care if I went to prison. I had nothing to lose anyway. I gave them the license plate number and a description of the man at the door. Tall, broad, greasy dark hair, thick beard. I asked if I would go to jail. The officer clicked the stop button on the recorder. "You sold drugs at a playground." "Not to kids." I stuck my chin out, defiant, like this made it better.
"You're going to be under arrest."
He was trying to be kind. "I have bail money." Evelyn's funeral money. The proverbial nail in the coffin lid. I wasn't allowed to leave. I was processed, strip-searched, and placed in a holding cell for 2 days, charged with sale of an illegal substance. But in the end, the playground moms wouldn't admit to buying anything from me. All they had was my confession of selling them. No evidence. I was led to a conference room, and the same young cop met me. I'd swear he had a crush.
"We've got bigger things to worry about," he said gravely.
His hair stood straight up, and he looked like he hadn't slept in 2 days.
"Those names you gave me? That car? Those girls? You got mixed up in sex trafficking.
There's a San Francisco PD task force for this. All the Bay Area PDs work with them. They've been tracking this guy for a long time. Your testimony, combined with the evidence they have, could bring it down. You told us something we didn't know. The brand.
I can't testify. Mick was a dangerous dude, but the guy who picked up Rosie? Downright terrifying.
You don't exactly have a choice.
He reached out and touched my hand, his clean, square-cut fingernails against my dirty, ragged ones. He smelled nice, like soap and aftershave. He wore a wedding ring. I wondered if his wife was as young as him. Perhaps pregnant with their first child, round and glowing, her days filled with baby sprinkles and pedicures. He probably rubbed her tired feet at night, massaged cocoa butter into her belly. She surely had many pairs of jeans that fit her, and that she washed in a machine, swirling fresh with Tide and fabric softener. She'd surely never done heroin, or sold drugs in the presence of children. I pulled my hand away. I'd taken the right steps not to be scum. I had to finish the job. When it all fell out, I told my story to a grand jury. I told the world, or at least my corner of it, what I did. The story never hit national media. The splash it made seemed large only to me and perhaps the 11 girls I helped to free, who may or may not ever thank me. Some of them seemed angry at their newfound freedom. But then again, at least under someone's thumb they were fed and clothed and kept appropriately high. I found out through the court proceedings, and the kind Richmond cop, that Mick was involved, which surprised me. Jared was the ringleader, but Mick worked for him. Jared sold drugs and girls, and Mick did his bidding. I couldn't help but wonder if Evelyn knew the extent of his criminal activities. Doubtful. I felt dirty. Like scum. Like I'd helped. Like I'd let Evelyn down somehow, yet again. I was allowed to go home, to Evelyn's crap apartment in San Pablo. I slept in her bed, with her nightgown and her blankets and her perfume and pillows. Drug and alcohol free. I had every intention of staying there. I even used my drug money to pay the rent. I wanted to find a job. I thought about calling my friends, but college felt like a million years ago. I had grown into a whole other person, one capable of hurting people, hurting myself, rescuing people. For a week after the trial, I woke up every day at a normal hour and made coffee, got the newspaper, checked the classifieds, like a real and decent human being. 8 days later, they came back for me.
Chapter 4. April 2014, New York City. When I wake up on Monday morning at 8, Henry is gone. His side of the bed is smooth and made, complete with cream brocade throw pillows. The tassels feather kiss my cheek. I stretch, a deep arch, and my fingertips brush a slip of paper. A note. I will be home for dinner tonight. Please ask Penny to prepare something. There are croissants in the kitchen. I let the paper flutter back to the bed. I can prepare dinner, and I have on occasion. But he always insists we ask Penny, which irritates me. I have all day in this echoing apartment, my own voice bouncing off the sterile, bare walls and marble floors. Sometimes I wonder if uselessness can kill a person. I have a waiting text message from Cash Murray. How's 10? I text back, see you there. In the kitchen, I break off a piece of flaky pastry and let it roll around my tongue, melting smooth as butter. I have no idea where he got them. In my new life, I've grown quite accustomed to luxuries just appearing out of nowhere. This is what it is like to live with Henry. I once found a note, and all it said was, Paris, tomorrow. And when I woke the next day, the car was humming outside, the trunk packed with suitcases I didn't know we owned, and clothing that wasn't mine. A black and white striped silk dress with wide-brim hats and Hermes scarves. My grown-out bob flowing behind me in the breezy fog tumbling off the Seine. Henry's dazzling smile across the chartered cruise boat. Are you happy? And my dodging reply, who wouldn't be happy? Because at least that part was true. Later I asked him, why Paris? And he gave a casual coy shrug. I've never been here. I wanted to see Paris. With you. It's a city for lovers, you know. His fingertips twisted my curls, tugging gently, a silent approval of letting my pixie cut grow. Then, his hot mouth, his tongue on my neck, the gold-leafed ceiling dancing and flickering in the candlelight. Then, after midnight, I pushed, as I always do. Under the cloak of blackness, my fingers finding his under the covers, half asleep, I whispered the questions into the air like a puff of smoke, and they hovered there between us. Tara, his life before me. He lay there so still and so quiet for so long I assumed he'd fallen asleep. When he got up, the cold air whooshed under the blankets like an arctic blast. He crossed the room, clicked the latch on the bathroom door. I fell asleep before he came back. It wasn't the first time I'd pushed him. My ideas of marriage formed by some hybrid of Lifetime television and Disney movies. I longed for the intimate connection I felt sure was buried beneath some surface hurt that only I could heal. I was the new wife, consoling the widower, cajoling him into love again, almost against his will. There, in the most romantic city in the world, under the glittering lights of the Eiffel Tower, his rebuff didn't feel like rejection. It felt like a challenge, a rom-com conflict scripted to a Peter Gabriel soundtrack. My phone rings, jostling me out of the memory.
Good morning, love.
Henry's voice rolls through the line like a rumbling locomotive, and I close my eyes.
Hey, you. How's your day?
I press my fingers to the white and black marble countertop and lick off the sticking crumbs.
Busy, but I wanted to hear your voice. What are you doing?
I was eating a croissant and remembering Paris for some reason.
Oh, God. I was just thinking about that the other day. That was an amazing trip. You were beautiful.
His voice catches, and I know he is remembering our nights. The long, lazy nights in the jacuzzi, our naked legs entwined. I give a soft giggle. Remember the rooftop? My heart pulses, and I feel the quick beat between my legs. I flash on the image of my back against the brick hotel, my dress hastily pushed up to my waist and Henry pressed up against me, my hands skimming his warm back, damp with perspiration from the July air. The clenching of his muscles as he came.
I can't talk about this here.
His tone is teasing, a low, breathy huff of pent-up frustration that breaks on the last word.
Tonight, we can remember it properly.
Okay. Okay.
Did you call Penny?
He speaks in a normal register, a return to business as usual. Not yet. I will. Or I'll cook. I do that sometimes. There is a pause.
Whatever you'd like.
I hear voices in the background.
Tonight. See you then.
He's gone. Just like that. I love making Henry weak. I love to see his stone face crack with a smile, or his dark, clever eyes cloud with want. I love this idea of him, powerful and in control in his boardroom, with its rich mahogany and skyline views, all steel peaks and clouds, and underneath his muscle and dominance, as he barks out orders that men scurry to fulfill, he is unfocused, thinking of me. He said that before. You drive me to distraction. I tend to believe that's one of the nicest things he's ever said to anyone. I dress quickly, and I'm in a cab in less than a half hour. The diner is no fuller than it was 2 days ago, and Cash is seated in the same booth, two steaming cups of coffee in the center of the gray and blue formica-topped table. I slide into the booth across from him, and he gives me a wide grin, folding his paper. He clicks open his laptop.
These photos are amazing. I cannot wait to show you.
His face is animated, his eyes wide, and voice hitches as he navigates the trackpad. His background is of a tow-headed child, freckled and gap-toothed. I wonder if she's his and check his hand. No ring. He clicks up a slideshow and turns the screen to face me. There are photos of Henry, breathtaking in his straight-cut suit and blonde hair glinting under the ballroom lights. He is watching me, staring at me, smiling at me in almost every photo. The shots of me are less confident, my head turned, my expression unsure or nervous. Candid shots where I am flicking back my hair or scanning the crowd or laughing in a small group. He has captured me beautifully, though, in fact, I can't even believe it's me. There are photos of photos, the large blown-up canvases of children tumbling together on a derelict playground, and shots of the decor, sparkling, dancing whitish-blue lights that look magical against the mirrored walls of the library. These are magnificent. How did you make it look like this? I'm practically speechless, and even as I reach the end of the slideshow and it starts over, I can't stop watching. He shrugs, a faint blush on his neck.
Well, cameras don't invent beauty that's not there. They just captured at the right moment. This is what the night really looked like.
He spins the laptop around to face him and begins to click.
These are the ones I want to use.
He shows me. There are 6 photos. 2 of them are of me. 1 in profile, head-to-head with a female guest, giggling like girlfriends, my face in shadow, and 1 with my arm linked through Henry's, my head resting on his shoulder. The rest are of Francesca, the event itself, the guests, the speaker. In the 2 photos of me, I can't see my features clearly. I'm in profile or turned, a vague angle, my face obscured. In 1 of the 6 photos, I can make out Molly and Gunther, and my heart lurches, an acrid taste in my throat. I trace them with my index finger on the screen. Please, just, you can use the 1 of me and Henry. You can remove the 1 of me in profile. I point to the screen, my tongue thick. He cocks his head to the side, just as my cell phone trills. The display reads, Lydia, but I press decline.
So, you knew that couple? They seemed to know you.
His voice contains the forced nonchalance of someone fishing. He adds cream and sugar to his coffee and stirs it slowly, the spoon clattering against the white porcelain. Oh, I didn't know them. They claim to know me from college or something, but... I force a laugh. College was a long time ago now, so who knows? I lift one shoulder and purse my lips, waving my hand. All I can think is, please change the subject.
Oh yeah? Where'd you go to school?
UCSF. It pops out before I can think it through, because being close to 30 means college almost never comes up. I used to have the story down pat, but it's been a while since I'd been asked. So the truth bubbled out like an uncorked spring. In an odd way, it's a relief to say it.
Oh, yeah? West Coast girl.
He strokes his chin thoughtfully and gives me a sideways grin. His teeth are straight, and he has a kind, jovial smile.
So, tell me, why are you so active in care? What made you choose that?
With slick movements, he clicks the recorder next to him, and I eye it before speaking.
Ignore this. I have to. I have zero memory for this stuff. I want to write about you a bit, though, if you don't mind.
His interest intrigues me. Henry is always interested in me, in my hair or my clothing, how I hold myself or how I present myself, what I've done or said at parties that needs mild correction later, what I've done with my day, my time. He's less interested, it seems, in my capricious ideas, my thoughts that flit here and there unfocused. Aside from my activities at care, he rarely asks my opinion on anything. I admit I don't always mind being under his thumb. There's a certain freedom in that, to not have to think about things in life, like what to eat for breakfast or dinner or where or what to shop, how to dress. He likes to teach me how to be in his world. He flicks away my concerns that I've never been fully accepted among the upper echelon. He shakes his head dismissively when I point out how the women pair off, heads tilted together almost systematically, at his functions until I'm left standing in the center of the room, awkwardly alone. But this is different. Cash seems genuinely interested in me, as a person, and the thrill I feel at that is almost embarrassing. It's not a romantic jolt, but not since Lydia have I had a friend. An honest friend. And, truthfully, Lydia has been more of an acquaintance since I married Henry. He's not a friend, though. This is all for an article. The thrill escapes, pfting like air out of a balloon. I was adopted, I say, slowly and flatly, twirling the spoon between my fingers. I dance around this, the truth addled somewhere in the middle, stuck in some emotional desert I can no longer access. My adoptive father died in a car accident when I was a baby. I never knew him. My adoptive mother died of ovarian cancer in 2009, my senior year of college. So I sympathize with these kids. Some are orphans, some are foster kids whose parents are drug-addled. I haven't had parents in a while, so I guess in a way I get it. I had a birth mother who didn't want me either. I've never said this to anyone, and it feels dangerous to admit this much of my old life, a life I am no longer entitled to call mine. Lately I find myself belligerently wanting it back, and, in small ways, throwing a stake in the ground. Even with the narrow escape of Friday night, the overall pervading fear has waned, and in its place is a dried-up seed of resentment. A peaceful 5 years means that I am reckless with my safety. More than that, admitting my past in parts feels safe, like the vent on a pressure tank.
Did you ever try to find her?
Who?
Your birth mother.
Not seriously. I don't know why. I guess for many years Evelyn was all I ever needed. She was my best friend. We never had that silly high school hate thing going. Not that I tried to get away with much anyway, or that she'd let me. I just felt like looking for my birth mother would have been an insult to her, or something.
What about now?
Now?
Yes, since she's passed. Why haven't you tried?
I shifted in my seat, tucking my left leg under me. There were 100 reasons. Finding Carolyn involved admitting on some level who I was before, either online or with a private investigator. Somehow, I had to use the name Hillary Lawler to get there. To move on, to continue to live, I had been forced to cleave my life with a giant chasm that held Hillary on one side and Zoe on the other. There was no bridge back, not in my mind. I held a little fear that Mick or Jared and his group were still behind me, pursuing me, or waiting for me to traverse that chasm again. It was as though once I crossed, once I became Zoe, Hillary ceased to exist. I didn't speak of her or think of her. I rarely recalled my past, instead choosing to pretend it hadn't existed, like I'd been born a full-grown adult named Zoe. Sometimes I fantasized that I'd fall ill and lose the memories altogether, except for Evelyn. I still wanted her. There were also the legal ramifications. I ran. I testified for a grand jury, but took off before Jared's trial. Jared was still convicted, partly because he'd branded all 11 of his girls. But I ran, despite subpoenas. I have no idea if anyone came after me, looked for me. In New York, among the shelters and the streets, I procured a driver's license and a phony birth certificate. They're surprisingly easy to come by if you ask the right questions. I looked like a drifter, unassuming and trustworthy. It cost me every cent I had at the time. But my identity wasn't mine, not legally anyway. Still, I felt safer than if I'd let Detective Maslow do it for me. I guess I can't explain it. I technically could. I've been sort of lost lately. Lost in my thoughts, the words fell out of my mouth unbidden, and until I said it, I hadn't known it was true. Sometimes things don't seem real until you verbalize them. I had been thinking about my mother, dreaming about her. The idea of looking for her again had seemed daunting and vague.
I did a feature series once. Adoptive Reunions. In Texas, 7, 8 years ago, Cash said, leaning forward across the table. I can help. Do you want me to help?
Are the society pages boring you? I teased, poking the air in his direction with my spoon. He sat back, crossing his arms.
Yes, K.
God, yes. Sometimes it's all I can do to stay awake. He scratched at the back of his neck, realizing his admission.
Not that your, event wasn't spectacular, and I met you and you've been great, but...
I laughed, letting him off the hook. I get it. So many rich people, so little time.
I live in a studio in the East Village. I mean, the lean months can be a special form of torture.
I have a vision of my mother, Evelyn, dignified in her starched hotel uniform, adorably cinched at the waist, pirouetting in the kitchen, leaving for a night shift while 16-year-old me licked peanut butter off a spoon. Evelyn worked as a housekeeper by day and a hotel maid by night or early morning, depending on her shift. Despite her patchwork jobs, we still struggled to make ends meet. We'd laughed at our poverty then, called it creative financing. Collecting dented cans of creamed corn that we'd eat over toast. That changed when she got sick the first time. It no longer felt as adventurous. It felt precarious, dancing on the edge of a razor blade. There were real consequences to poverty, I learned. I remember lean months. A waitress appears, her heavy blue-lidded eyes darting back and forth between our single cups of coffee. I can see her calculating the tip and trying not to roll her eyes. Cash pays the tab over my protest.
So, let me help you.
He bites his lip. He seems very into the idea. We'll see, okay? Write the story, see what you come up with. Will you send it to me before you run it? I am concerned about the pictures. I realize the pictures combined with my admission of being from San Francisco could sink me. I haven't been this stupid in years. Not at least since that New York Magazine feature photo with me hiding in the corner, but still somehow with a maniacal rictus grin. While I don't think I'm actively being pursued, the idea of hiding is long ingrained. The thought of going back claws at the back of my throat.
Yeah, of course.
We stand to leave together. Out of the corner of my eye, I see his hand hovering lightly above my back, guiding me out. Men and their shows of chivalry. He opens the door for me, and I step out into the busy sidewalk. The sun is gleaming, and I squint, fishing around in my pocketbook for sunglasses. Call me when you have the article written. I really loved the photos, Cash. You're a talented photographer. I pause then because I'm being sincere and his smile is wide, a faint flush in his cheeks from the compliment. He walks with me to the corner where I will go uptown and he will head downtown to his office. The white walk sign blinks, and I step off the curb. The roar of an engine is the only sound I hear. The voices of the crowd are muted. I look up and freeze. A car is careening through the intersection, its headlights bouncing as the car hits a pothole. My feet are solid lead blocks glued to the pavement. Suddenly, something hits me hard and I feel myself tumble through the air. I scream and close my eyes, my fingers losing their grip on my purse strap. When I open my eyes, Cash is breathing hard on the ground next to me, a sheen of sweat on his forehead, his eyes wildly scanning the intersection. The car, in retrospect it was a gray sedan, glinting in the sunlight, is nowhere around. It turned left, someone from the crowd points to the alley.
Did you get a plate number?
Cash shouts back before scrambling up and running halfway down the street in the direction the car turned. He decidedly gives up, jogging back to me. I sit up. My shoulder burns where it hit the pavement.
What the hell was that?
Someone says. A slight Hispanic man is crossing the intersection, wiping his hands on his white apron. He's left his food cart across the street and his eyes are wild.
That car, miss.
He is breathless and nervous.
Are you all right? He saved your life.
He gestures toward Cash, who is preoccupied looking up and down the street. I nod and stand up, half embarrassed, and force a laugh. They must have been drunk.
Ah, no, miss. That was no drunk. He was parked, you see, right there.
He points to his peanut cart.
Across from me, for an hour or more. When you cross the street, he gunned the engine.
What do you mean? Like he was trying to hit us?
Cash stands, belligerent with his hands on his hips, ready for a fight with the unknown driver.
Not you, sir. You headed the other way.
He shrugged apologetically and pointed to me.
He was after her.
Chapter 5. The idea of going home to my apartment just to sit there holds no appeal. Cash hadn't wanted to leave me, but no one had a license plate number. A small crowd had gathered, and someone patted me on the shoulder, meant as comfort, I suppose. There wasn't anything anyone could do, and I had doubts that the car had really been after me. It seemed too random, too surreal. I figured it more likely that the driver had simply been careless or distracted, realized he was late, and in a panic ran a red light. I shooed Cash back to his office to write his piece. Reluctantly, he began his walk downtown, but kept glancing back in my direction. I walk uptown on 6th Avenue, all 22 blocks, and stand uncertainly outside the glass and mirror front of Le Fleur de Lys. Even with the hike uptown, my heart is still thundering from the near miss. It's been a while since I've been back, almost a year, and my cheeks flush. I picture Lydia in the back room, prepping and cutting, and Elisa in the front, relaying celebrity gossip through the propped-open industrial steel door. Le Fleur is primarily an event florist, designer to the stars. Elisa has long held one of the top spots for floral design in the city. I shake my hands at my sides and wriggle my shoulders to loosen them up. This is a completely terrible idea. But I have nowhere else to go. I have half a mind to just turn around and go home or duck into a boutique, anything. I stare at the sea of taxis, a yellow tide, and my eyes glaze over. The decision is made for me.
Well, well, look what the cat dragged in.
Lydia is standing in the doorway, her arms folded over her chest and her feet crossed at the ankles. Something glitters on her eyebrow.
Is that a new piercing?
I squint at her and give her a friendly smile. I hope it works.
Is that Armani?
She juts her chin at me. I hold my hands up, palms out. Her black spiky hair is tipped with blue. Long dangling earrings, black leather and lace getup. Possibly fishnet stockings under a long black gauze skirt. Red lipstick curled around blinding white teeth. We used to sit on that stoop and smoke cigarette after cigarette. She steps back, holds open the door. Her head jerks toward the front room. I walk through the door and she bumps me with her shoulder. The shop is bursting with color and I'm nostalgic. The front shop, small and exclusive, is open by appointment only. Cast-offs and leftover blooms are sold to small corporate banquets or private clientele. The library looked incredible the other night. Thank you. I dip my head, avert my eyes.
Thank Javi. He did the designs, not me.
She walks ahead of me, waves me back into the back room, which looks typically chaotic.
He's not here, though, although he'll be sorry he missed you.
Sorry like a hawk, I think. Steel buckets of blooms littered with cuttings and flowers that had been deemed not quite perfect, although that to any passerby would look magnificent on the dining room table. I pick up a long-stem peach rose, fingering a single nicked and browning petal. There are more rejects than usual, which can only mean one thing. Wedding this weekend? I gather a few velvety irises, their stamens a stark tiger orange against the deep purple backdrop.
It's the Slattery wedding.
Lydia is at the prep table clipping manically, her metal shears clattering on the stainless steel table.
We can't do too much until Wednesday, but some of the hardier types can be prepped now.
I watched her splice stems on a bias with a knife, turn leaves back and shape greenery. If I close my eyes, I can imagine I still work here. Lydia and me side by side clipping and cutting with identically bandaged thumbs. I twirl my wedding band around my ring finger. Landing the Slattery wedding is impressive. Michael Slattery has been in the top half of the 10 most eligible bachelors list for almost a decade. I'd seen him with a leggy brunette at receptions and parties with Henry. I forgot her name. Natalie? Natasha? Ah, Nadine something. I resist the urge to touch one of the wayward blooms, position it back into place. Suggest that the vibrant orange could be highlighted by peach, not yellow. These were the arguments of old Zoe and Lydia. We are new people with a new friendship. If she'll have me back.
So, where you been, Zo?
She gives me a smirk and the corner of her scarlet mouth tips up.
I called you.
Yeah, I know. The event book is laying on the worktop and I flip through it. The pages are outlined with design ideas, colors, and specifications. I know in the front there is a bio of the bride and groom, but I don't read it. Where's Elisa? I ask.
She has a class this morning.
I glance at the clock. It is noon. Elisa teaches workshops at the New York School of Floral Design. A teaching day means she won't be back until after 2. At least, that's how it used to be. I reach out and cover Lydia's hand, which is tugging on a rose leaflet. Her knuckles feel rough under my palm. She falters and curses, dropping the stem. A thick drop of blood blooms on her thumb. An amateur mistake. I rip off a paper towel and hand it to her. Let's get lunch. We walk the 2 blocks to Sam's, and Lydia tends to her thumb like it's a surgical incision. She inspects it and wraps it, squeezes it, unwraps it, pushes out a thick bead of blood. The cafe looks the same. Warm browns and covered wall-to-wall in art, bright frames with shocks of color, mosaic tables and iron chairs. The sounds of soft, jazzy saxophone float through the air. Sam is parked behind the counter. His prematurely gray hair has grown out, but he's wearing a t-shirt I actually recognize, despite how long it's been since I've been here.
Zoe!
He jumps up with his arms out, and I awkwardly hug him across the countertop, the cash register between us pressed against my shoulder.
The usual?
He gives me a wink, and I laugh and nod. I watch him add caramel and milk to a large cardboard cup. Lydia says something right as he flips on the froth machine. She motions to a table, and we sit.
Stop being mad at me,
I say, too loudly, just as the whir of the cappuccino maker dies down. I can handle Lydia's moods, her temper tantrums, snarled comebacks, and caustic sarcasm, but her silence has always killed me. Lydia is gifted in silence. Her stone walls stretch out, echoing and cold like a glacial plain. Her face cracks a smile. She has laugh lines around her mouth that are new.
You always cave.
Sam brings us coffee and a plate of baked goods, baguettes and brie, croissants with cranberry jelly. We butter in silence.
I'm not mad at you. I miss you. Is that so bad?
She avoids eye contact. Lydia doesn't do sentimental. I don't know what to say. We've never been Hallmark card friends. No, that's not bad. I miss you too. I want to tell her everything. Molly and Gunther, the car, Cash, Henry. It floods my mouth, gathers right behind my teeth. I swallow.
So what gives? Is this really the first time I've seen you in almost a year?
She pushes brie and croissant into her mouth, and I drop my baguette onto the plate, my appetite waning. No, I saw you. I squint my eyes and look up at the ceiling. In January, at the Peters's baby shower. I snap my fingers triumphant. She hangs her mouth open.
That was accidental. We did the arrangements, you were a guest, and it was awkward as hell.
I didn't think it was awkward, I lie. Then offer feebly, you looked great. So did Javi. You all did.
We used to live together, see each other every day. I get when you get married you can't stay chained to me all the livelong day, but a year? I mean, come on. I've called you. I still call you.
I know. I cross my legs and my knee hits the table. Coffee splotches on my wrist. Besides, we've chatted. It's not like I've ignored you. We've just been busy.
Bullshit.
I bite my cheek to keep from smiling. In a world where every other person seems to have a hidden agenda or unfathomable motivations, I miss Lydia. She doesn't wait for me to answer.
So what gives? Why now?
I just need you back in my life.
I'm sorry. Is that enough?
She flicks her fingers, casting crumbs in my direction, and shrugs.
Probably. How's Henry Higgins?
I ignore the jibe. He's a lot busier. I'm alone a lot. Do you think Elisa would let me, I don't know, volunteer once in a while? I say the last part in a rush.
Where, at the shop?
Her eyes grow wide, the diamond stud winking in her eyebrow. Yeah? Dumb idea, maybe. I fiddle with my fork, depressing my fingertip along the tines until it hurts.
I'm sure she would. Are you okay?
I miss just being here. I miss the smell, the thrill of designing, you. I even miss her ridiculous demands.
2 coffees, 1 hot, 1 cold, 7 napkins, please.
Lydia's voice pitches an affected French accent that mimics Elisa's, and we exchange smiles.
Why are you alone?
Because Henry's busy. He works 7 days a week. Our apartment is huge. I feel like a marble in a jar. I need something to do. I feel useless.
You have your charity, right?
Yeah, I do. The benefit was incredible. I smile at the memory and she clucks a sound of mocking approval. But I can't do it all the time, every day.
Will Henry let you?
I try to pretend this is a ridiculous question. Will he let me, as though this is 1955? I roll my eyes, but I don't answer.
Ha, you won't tell him. Her voice is flat. Seriously, Zoe, what kind of marriage is it where
you act like he's abusive? I push my plate away, and it clatters against the table. Lydia doesn't understand relationships, the give and take. She never has. I think of the parade of men, tall, short, thin, stocky. She didn't subscribe to any particular type. She consumed men, devoured them, until she was their world. As soon as any of them ever asked anything of her, to change in any way, even if just to be around them more. Maybe not work 12 to 14 hours at a flower shop, because let's face it, we weren't saving lives. She'd be gone. And, if asked, she'd reduce them to nothing with a little sideways twitch of her nose, like they'd never existed. Oh, Carl. Eye roll. Simply because they wanted her too much. It was exhausting.
No, I just think he likes to be in control.
I push down a flash of anger. Lydia, stop. He's protective. He has a right to be. He's been traumatized by his past. I lower my voice. He was married before, but she died in a car accident. She clamps her mouth shut in a thin line. She wants to ask details, I can tell, but she doesn't.
Good thing, because I don't know any.
He still has nightmares about it, kicking the sheets and shouting her name in his sleep. Tara. Sam hovers near the cream and sugar counter, feet from our table. He fiddles with all the lids, stacking them one way, then the other, and when he can't seem to find a reason to be there any longer, he turns and heads back to the kitchen. The music volume drops to a barely audible level. We had so much fun in that crap apartment in Hoboken, I say. I remember the cramped quarters, only a hanging sheet separating our beds. A thin guise of privacy in anticipation of all the single activities that were sure to come. By the second week, we'd tied it back against the wall, tacked with kitchen twine and a pushpin. The apartment contained only a living room, big enough for a single plaid monstrosity of a couch that we dragged in from street pickup, and a kitchenette fit for a child.
Hey, did you ever find Carolyn?
She cocks her head to the side, her eyes brightening. When I met Henry, I was immersed in the search. Lydia and I had scoured newspapers from San Francisco, internet websites on adoption, even cold-called some long-lost aunt of Evelyn's. Lydia was a perfect companion. Her lust for mystery and her creativity propelled me long after I might have given up. We never found anything. Lydia knows about my adoption, but not about Mick. And only Mick knows what I did to Evelyn. Then I got caught up with Henry and gave up. My earlier conversation with Cash echoes back to me. I shake my head. I haven't looked again. Isn't that weird? I sort of just forgot. I still think about it sometimes, but not enough to actually do anything about it. I'm suddenly struck with the need to have a biological connection to someone, an unbreakable tether that might keep me from flying away in Henry's wind. Two conversations about my mother's in one day is enough to cause panic. Sam appears at my elbow, brandishing chocolates. We each take one. The candy coats my tongue sweet and feathery, decadent. He wisps away, leaving a trail of polo in his wake.
I can help you look.
I shrug and flip my fingers at her. She leans back and folds her arms across her chest.
You're just so fucking different now.
She says this as though it isn't a matter of opinion and is also no big deal.
What is that? Silk?
She touches the sleeve of my blouse with her pinky. I yank my arm away involuntarily. I hate being scrutinized, studied. I've lived so long feigning normality, invisibility, I forget how it is to be conspicuous. With Lydia, suddenly, I feel conspicuous. Uncomfortable in my own silk blouse.
Your hair is all one color, and it's so damn long.
This is true. I've gotten compliments about my hair from strangers in public. The short, angled punk bob I kept when Lydia and I lived together has grown into a thick chestnut mane that flows just to my shoulders. I don't say it's because Henry likes it to tickle his face when I slide on top of him.
Let me help you look.
She wouldn't be Lydia if she picked up subtle hints. The light from the window filters through her dyed blue hair, giving her a hazy azure glow. I shrug like this is no big deal, but my heart hammers a staccato rhythm against my ribcage. I shake my head. It's one thing to accept Cash's help. That's professional. It's another to reach out to Lydia, who still holds anger. With Cash, I could call it off at any moment. Oh, never mind, it was a silly idea, ha-ha. Lydia wouldn't accept that. She'd push and dig with her sharp eyes and capable hands until she'd unearthed every sordid thing about my life, lay it bare for Henry to see. No matter what Lydia said, Henry was all I had left. I glance at my watch. It is after 2. Elisa will be back in the shop, angry about Lydia's absence, the closed sign, the empty storefront. We pay the tab. I throw an extra 10 on the table when Lydia isn't looking. I can't be sure that the motivation is entirely altruistic, and I flash back to Sam lingering near the table, his ears turned to our conversation. I did not dream up his curiosity. Was I saving face? I might be under someone's thumb, but I have money now. The walk back to the shop is short, and Lydia threads her arm through mine, bumping my hip as she walks.
Can we do this again? Soon?
She asks, unusually timid.
Will you talk to Elisa about my proposal? About coming back? Say, one day a week?
It'll be like old times.
Lydia flashes a red and white smile. The shop is still empty, locked up and dark when we arrive, and Lydia sneaks in, flipping on the lights and propping the door open as though she'd never left. We hug, but quickly. An obligatory back pat and air kiss. Lydia and I are bonded in our discomfort with physical contact. I scurry down to the corner and hail a cab. I'm halfway home before I even remember the careening car. I can't decide if I will tell Henry or not. It seems so silly. A careless driver, an inopportune walk sign. Not even worth bringing up, really. And besides, he'll only worry. He worries so much.
Chapter 6 Penny makes dinner after all. A finely sliced raw tuna over a bed of crispy radicchio and a loaf of crusty bread drizzled with garlic and olive oil. Henry likes light dinners because of his heavy lunches, surrounded by leather and mahogany with cigars, steak, and a silky cabernet. The table is set when I arrive home, and I yell a greeting into the kitchen where I hear Penny humming something sensual and jazzy. I run upstairs to change into jeans and a soft button-down shirt. I pull my hair into a low casual bun and make it back downstairs just as Henry arrives through the front door. He gives me a brilliant smile, all teeth and crinkled eyes, and my breath hitches. His arms wrap around my middle and he kisses me full on the